This is Joel Spolsky, the host of the Stack Overflow podcast. Our podcast depends on listeners like you, who aren't you because you're already listening, and we need more listeners like you. We don't have any kind of fancy marketing budget, so please, if you enjoy this podcast, tell your friends to subscribe. Thank you.
Trello is my favorite real-time collaboration environment. Pick that, Atlassian, or whatever your real name
they
is.
They did, yes.
Yeah, wait. I threw it. Hello and welcome to the Stack Overflow podcast, episode 107, recorded Thursday, April 27th, 2017 at Stack Overflow headquarters in New York, New York, the city that invented rats, where more than 8 million people live in peace and endure the burdens of democracy. I am today's unusual host, Anil Dash, in for the usual host, Joel Spolsky, and today's podcast is brought to you by CSV, the comma-separated values format, which makes the entire world financial system go around. Also brought to you by Glitch, which is at glitch.com, community where you can make the app of your dreams, try out new APIs, maybe explore some technologies you haven't played with before. A lot of fun. Maybe we'll talk about it a little bit later. And we have a ton of great co-hosts and guests on today's podcast, including VP of Engineering, David Fullerton.
Hello.
VP of Stack Overflow, Jay Hanlon.
Hello.
News editor, Ilana Itzaki.
Yeah, hi.
Engineering manager, Matt Sherman.
Hello.
And we have very special guests from Practical Dev today in the studio here with us, Jess Lee and Ben Halpern.
Hey.
Awesome to be here.
Great. We're glad to have you. I think we are off to a roaring start. Let's jump right into it. First, I want to actually throw us to our one-minute tech review. David, are you there with our tech review?
Yes.
Good.
Senior tech review correspondent David Fullerton here, reporting for duty. Okay, so here's the setup. So I'm in the hospital for a family member. I call an elevator. The elevator shows up. I get onto the elevator. It goes down one floor, the doors open, I wait, nobody gets on, they close, goes down another floor, the doors open, nobody gets on, they close, goes down another floor, the doors open, and about somewhere in here I figure something unusual is happening here. So, I found out there is this thing, Sabbath Elevator Service.
Mm-hmm. Named after Black Sabbath.
Which is very common in New York.
Yeah.
And I was trying to understand and explain this to my coworkers earlier, but I was doing a terrible job. So Ilana said she's going to explain to us how this works.
That's right. Okay. So the idea on Shabbat, or the Sabbath, as you guys know it, is that there's no work. You can't create a spark. You can't create fire.
And no pushing buttons.
Well, that's the issue is not riding on the elevator. It's pushing the button. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, it's also the lights that you can create different lights lighting up as you move from floor to floor. But it's also deemed a little bit like it's not Shabbistic. It's like you're not going to get into a car even though you're not driving. It's just something that you don't want to be doing on that day because it's the thing that you're not supposed to be doing. But obviously, you're not going to walk up to, you know, your 50th floor apartment or, you know, you're on the 20th floor of a hotel. And you have them in synagogues. Actually, there's one on the Upper West Side that has a Sabbath elevator. And many of the hospitals in New York have them as well. There are certain sects of Judaism, certain rabbis that say that, you know, this is prohibited, that you shouldn't be doing it, that it violates the Sabbath. But, you know, it's definitely a loophole and it makes your life easier.
And it's not that uncommon here in New York City either. We get office buildings that have
it's like on the Upper East Side, all the hospitals have this on mm-hmm. Saturdays. Shabbos is Friday sundown to Saturday sundown?
Yes, sundown to sundown, 24 hours.
See, I thought this was a programming error was going to be the joke that somebody wrote some code for the elevator. It's an N plus one problem. Somebody wrote some code that says, move the elevator 14 floors, so it goes, it navigates to 14 floors.
Right.
No. Okay, so this is my tech review for two reasons. One, I found the UI very confusing because there was no indication that this is what was going on. I don't even remember how I found out. Somebody told me.
Well, there should be a sign on the outside with an arrow that points to the elevator and says Sabbath elevator.
So I eventually got off and I looked, and instead of where the floor usually shows up, it said SB or something. And then that's, I think that's how I figured it out.
The documentation error.
So UI. UI was a little bit confusing. But what I actually thought, I think is really interesting about this is just thinking about this sort of in terms of like designing accessible systems and accessible UIs, right? Basically that, one, this is something you would never, as you know, your average software developer is never going to, a use case, they're just never going to think of unless they come from that particular culture or tradition. And, you know, I just thought it was an interesting example of, you know, designing a very accessible system to accommodate this particular belief, sort of something that you wouldn't think of that you need to listen to your users and the members of your community to even know that this is a use case that you need to handle.
One of the things I like about it is accessibility often has these sort of like unexpected benefits for everybody else that doesn't use it. Right. So in hospitals, there's a lot of people, like a disproportionately high number of people who are going to have dexterity issues or trouble pushing a button or just don't want to like go and push the button. And so like the fact that they've got one where they don't have to do that is a benefit to them, whether that's their faith or their belief or not.
The only problem is that they have to wait until Friday.
Yeah, well, you know.
The fact that they built this into the system at all provides sort of the functionality for extension as well. If they didn't build this in at all, it might not even be possible to build in something of similar value in another case.
Yeah, yeah, working backwards from it. Or even like curb cuts. I always think of like every time I'm rolling my suitcase somewhere and there's a curb cut and it wasn't made for me, but like now I can use it. I'm like, this is a bonus.
It's funny. Yeah, it's like curb cuts are a thing you never even see until you're trying to roll something or pushing a stroller is where I now encounter them.
Right.
And suddenly you're like looking for them everywhere.
I feel like we're all very focused on the accessibility issue and how to optimize that. And what nobody seems to care about is the tragic loss of jobs here, because observant Jews used to bring Gentiles around with them if they had the means.
What?
On.
So they're called Shabbos goys.
See?
And they do use them sometimes.
Is that a gig
really?
I can still get?
If you live next to a Jew, they will use you
buttons.
As the Shabbos goy.
I 100% really? Know how to push elevator buttons.
I'm only like 98% on elevator buttons. I gotta
on the
be
internet,
honest.
I'm really good at pushing people's buttons.
All right. So anyway, that's my tech review. Sabbath elevators, I give them a thumbs up.
But that thumb is good, not pushing the button.
No,
exactly.
It's just
got it.
Happens to be up.
All right. Thank you, David, for reporting in. I think it is time for us to move quickly to Jay's rant. Jay Hanlon, are you there with a rant ready?
I am. I have been thinking long and hard about the various and multitude things I am angry about.
Yikes.
And I've summoned up the appropriate level. So I'm traveling a little bit. I'm out in Denver, which I believe is the weirdly over-orchestrated Epcot Center-like state, maybe the city. But as you travel, there's something, if you've stayed in a hotel room, you used to just get to a hotel room and there was just a room. There were no choices or instructions one had to make. But now, whenever you stay at a hotel room, there's a little card. It's always a card folded in half. And the card basically starts every time the same way. And it says, we care about the environment. It's a note from the multinational conglomerate that owns the hotel you're staying at. And it leads with how much they care about the environment. And they are pleading with you to join them in their quest for green glory, in leaving your towels on hangers and not throwing them on the floor. If they're on the floor, they will change them for you and change your sheets and wash everything and give you clean ones. And they hope you, like them, are passionate about the environment. And these notes infuriate me, not because I don't care about the environment, but because I don't like liars. And the note starts with, we care about the environment. And all I can think is, oh, I can tell because you clear cut half of the Berkshires to build three casinos and have basically terraformed most of the desert in Las Vegas to build a lake next to a pool for a vaguely racist Asian-themed hotel that is larger than most American cities. You don't care about the environment. What you care about is the money you save from not just not washing towels, but the fact that they used to have to replace every towel and sheet almost every year. And if they could get everyone to not want them cleaned every, you know, however long a stay is, they wouldn't have to do it. And the hypocrisy and lies infuriate me, because what they could say is, by not washing your towels, we keep our room prices down, and you can help the environment. And they could still appeal to my love of the environment.
And your love of saving money.
Without being dirty, filthy liars and hypocrites. And it reminds me of when I was a kid, and at the end of the G.I. Joe cartoon show, it would basically have this lesson in morality that ended with knowing is half the battle. And all I could think was, you purveyors of glorious children's wartime television in which you were taught that war kills no one and no harm is ever done. I will get my moral lessons from someone with more credibility on ethics, like, say, the CEO of a major ride sharing app. And that is my take on hotels.
I want to go back to how Cobra's troops always had parachutes. Like, this is a really...
These planes are carpet bombing whole regions of Cobra-controlled territory, right. And little safe people are popping
how
out
did they
and shoots.
What did they make
no
the parachutes for Cobra troops out of that they never got killed in the cartoon? Like, I have real concerns about this, right?
And
this
why is, not yeah, make the right, planes the out of the same Black stuff Fox, and save yeah. the steps?
No, it's right. too heavy. That's
we didn't have G.I. Joe in Canada, so I grew up right.
Wow. That's well. How did you learn violence as a child?
That's because you have Mounties, right? And they wear those hats and they ride moose into combat.
What were Mountie the bootleg Joe? X-Men that you had up there?
The bootleg X-Men.
There's like,
We got bootleg lots of stuff.
Now that we own you, have we given you G.I. Joe? Is it fixed?
I was familiar with G.I. Joe as a kid. We had the toy, but I don't think we got it on TV. We had our own channel.
The toy, but not the story.
Somebody will tweet this at me, but there was a lesser X-Men, like other mutants that were like
Canadian
other,
mutants.
Others.
I don't
there
know.
Was also a bootleg Sesame Street. Right? Yeah.
We had Sesame Park. I remember that.
Sesame Park?
Yeah.
Because you don't have streets. Park? I get it.
Sesame Link. We live in rounded snow little houses.
Right.
And we ride.
There's a house in quotes there.
Yeah, and wrestle bears, right? You wrestle bears on the weekend.
Absolutely.
That's Alpha Flight. Alpha Flight. Does that sound like a thing?
Maybe. I don't know.
All right. I'm going to rely on the internet to practice.
I don't have cable. Like Sesame Park is like the extent of my childhood.
Were you in none of it? Were you like, were you just so far from civilization? Yeah, I'm not having none of it because I'm not really into it.
It's a territory, so I'll
territory.
I'll let you ignorant Americans pass on that one.
So in Quebec, did it have to be called Sesame Boulevard?
The French word for park is park.
Oh, come on. That doesn't... What about Sesame?
I don't know.
So basically French just copied us, pretty much.
Hard to determine the origins of these things.
Yeah.
I don't mean to digress from our rant about Canada. And of course, I am glad that we were able to properly vilify the hotel industry. But we have important work to do also in preparing the ongoing process of creating a constitution for Stack Overflow. Jay Hanlon, do you have any feelings or opinions about how we might go about doing such a thing?
I do. As you know, on Stack Overflow and in the United States, we have a constitution, unlike in Canada, where as far as I can tell, the moose are in charge. And each week we bring you, our listeners, a proposal, which you will decide if it becomes a part of our new constitution. Before we get to the motion to introduce a new constitutional amendment to the Stack Overflow constitution, we will first visit the results of last week's proposal, for which I will flip it over to our news editor, Ilana Itzaki. What did we learn?
66% said con.
Con.
Yes.
Con. As you may recall, last week the question was, pro meant we would prohibit, we would heretofore forbid replying in line since it suggests you are being a petty pedant and generally encourages technical correctness.
That was a bunch of alliteration that just went by there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I can't do an alliteration that includes the word alliteration. I tried. But pro would have meant you may no longer reply in line. You should reply in a big, polite phrasing. Con, which apparently won, means let us continue to pick out each sentence and shout nonsense and explain why it is nonsense to the original writer.
Is it that surprising that a Stack Overflow audience would be in favor of nitpickery? I think not.
We are proud of our consistency, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So who was the winner of our...
We have two winners, actually. And
this is unprecedented.
Well, so these two guys got very creative and used each other's tweets to prove their points, basically. And so Haikus by Isaac, and it's great. You can go on the Twitter page and see it. It looks a lot better than me explaining it. Haikus by Isaac and Asger. Haikus by Isaac started off with con. That's got my vote. You cannot reply in line. This is clearly false. Asger replied with in line, con. That's got my vote. Pro is mine. You cannot reply in line. This is clearly false. And then Haikus by Isaac responded, con, that's got my vote. Pro is mine. Of course it is, eponymously. Because Asger is the one who suggested this constitution question. I don't know
this
if that was...
This is a lot of work.
You
really
have to look at it.
Yeah, it only works visually, but it's
exactly.
Incredibly elaborate.
Do they know the only prize
clever
is a sticker?
They did.
It is. It
the
is.
Very exciting thing for me is, I believe when we asked the question last week, I tried to rig the election by strongly urging everybody to vote con, and con came in with 66% of the vote. So just want to point out, democracy is a sham and rigging elections works.
After hearing Ilana try to describe this completely visual dialogue back, I think we should add a segment where there is like a complex choreographed dance.
Oh, there was
Ilana
one.
Describes
oh, you missed the dance. There was a whole thing.
You didn't see this, Jenny?
Was,
you didn't
do you
see
remember,
this?
You know, an NSYNC's Bye 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 with the arms? It was that.
Did you just ask if I remembered NSYNC's Bye Bye Bye?
The choreography, I'm saying. I don't think you forgot the song. I just am asking if you have the whole choreography memorized.
Jay actually, for a long time, had. He may still have a little marionette dolls of entire NSYNC.
Sure, that was in the video, right?
Yeah, well, there's no strings attached.
In his office.
There we go.
Yeah, okay. It's pretty important.
He actually, this isn't even a joke, he had the dolls in his office.
I'm not joking about us dancing.
I would appreciate being afforded the respect of using the correct tense because only the lesser NSYNC characters have been removed by the original owner. I obviously still have J-Tim hanging from his marionette strings in my office right now.
Wow, you took it out of the box. I guess you're not a real fan.
The real fans play with it, buddy.
That's right. It's the collectors who keep them in the box because they're planning to resell
them. Are we off topic? I think so. I'm going to drag us back.
Is there a topic?
NSYNC is never off topic.
What if we wanted to continue this sham of constitution process that we've created? And perpetuating
well, that
forward.
Would bring us to today's constitutional question, which of course is Justin Timberlake the best performer of all time or the awesomest performer of all time? And don't say they're the same. There's a distinction. And I think that's actually not our proposal for today, although we will save it for next week.
Oh, I'm disappointed.
Today's constitutional question, proposed by @PaulMorris, two R's, two S's, the rest like it sounds, on what day of the week do this weekend and next weekend mean something different? And for this particular one, I wanted to introduce it as he did. We'll have to parse it out a little bit and then form a pro and con for our audience. But this is a critical question facing us, in my opinion, because people say next Friday, and sometimes they mean the Friday that's about to happen, and sometimes they mean the Friday after that, and it is an unacceptable ambiguity.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, this is a great question.
So what's the pro and con version?
So...
because in my world, this Friday always means
this coming.
The immediate this coming subsequent Friday.
And next Friday means the
next
one
Friday
after
that happens in the world is this Friday.
And once you get to Friday, then this Friday is today.
Then this Friday
this
is
weekend.
Yes, otherwise you'd say today.
It's confusing. I don't think you would say this Friday on a Friday.
So pro means when you say this, it always means the next upcoming version of whatever
proximate.
That is.
The proximate.
Well,
yes.
Next requires there is a this version ahead of you, and next would be the subsequent one of those. And for clarity, today does not count.
Less clear than you started when you started explaining.
That's what I do, Anil.
So the choice is between this and next, meaning the proximate Friday. Is that correct? With the distinction that we've just made? The yes and no, the pro and con?
So today we are recording on Thursday. Oh my God. This Thursday and next Thursday are the same.
Right.
What?
No. Okay, so we're saying pro is there's no ambiguity. It's always this Friday is tomorrow and next Friday is the following week. Con would be then... at some point, it changes, I guess.
Let
some
me return to the source
that.
Material from PaulMorris, two R's, two S's, which says, on what day of the week does this weekend and next weekend mean something different?
Okay, that's a different question.
Right.
But it has to be framed
as a pro or con.
He didn't follow directions.
I think we can get a pro and a con framing out of this if we really apply ourselves and put our hearts into it. So if we say, today is a Thursday as we tape this, this weekend we would probably all agree is that this begins tomorrow night or the day after tomorrow, right? And next weekend... most people, I think, would mean not this week, but next week's weekend.
Okay. So in this question, there is an assumption that that turning point, inflection point exists.
Right. That there is a day of pivot.
Okay.
Before which this weekend and next weekend mean the same thing. After which this weekend and next weekend mean different things.
Interesting. Okay. So to participate here, you have to accept that premise.
Right.
Which I think most of us would.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if it's Monday and we say this weekend and next weekend, we probably mean the same time, mm-hmm. the Friday following that Monday. We disagree. Mm. All right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's complicated, but if you say this weekend, you might be referring to this past weekend.
Yeah.
We're not talking about the past.
What did you do this weekend?
Yeah, that is the wrongest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. Okay.
No.
Right?
What did you do this
Tuesday.
Weekend? Another
right,
wrench
let's
thrown
go to
into
Tuesday.
It.
If it was Tuesday and you say this Monday, I could potentially think it was yesterday.
But I want to stick to weekends because I think that gives us the clarity to do a pro and a con because this and that is going to get.
I guess if you're in it, then it's this.
Right.
Right. But
and Monday you would say this weekend because what did you do this weekend?
Yeah. But so it's Saturday. If you say this weekend, you mean this. But if it's Sunday and I say, what are we doing this weekend? I probably mean the next one.
Whoa. It's
all
not.
Right. Somebody just decide what's
right.
pro
so
and con here.
Well, this is
so
interesting because it flips.
We can vote. And we're going to use democracy to solve this problem.
It doesn't actually, it's not that half the week it's one way and half the week it's the other way. It actually alternates by day. Okay. Let's get a pro and con out of this.
Here. No, pro. Pro means that when one says this weekend, they are referring to the upcoming weekend, the next upcoming weekend, on Monday through Friday and Saturday. But on Sunday, when they say this weekend, they are referring to the following weekend that has not yet begun. Is pro. Con is anything else.
Okay.
I'm going to turn back the tape and re-listen to that before I vote.
I'm going to reduce this.
I just don't even know.
Pro is that this weekend set on Sunday applies to the following weekend, not the one you were in.
Correct. That's okay. The first day when that is true.
That's it. Got it. Okay.
Yep. And how does this change if instead of English, we're talking about it's JavaScript?
I think you get NaN.
This means you get a range. To me.
Yes.
Well, I'd argue that any question best asked to John Skeet for an answer, this might be one of those things that John Skeet is uniquely qualified to answer. Wow. So if you listened to all of that, oddly, and in the unlikely event that you are able to follow small pieces of it, please post your answer to Twitter using the hashtag #StackOverflowPodcast with either pro or con and your explanation, which should be short but funny, like Daniel Tosh is not. The most entertaining explanation, whether on the winning side or the losing side, will be read on next week's podcast, and an author will win an amazing Bic 4-color pen. Put your days of carrying 4 separate pens behind you and never be caught without both blue and black ink again. Alternately, you can win a Stack Overflow sticker, in either case, courtesy of the Stack Overflow podcast. You may also submit your ideas for future constitutional amendments, and one of them could even be named after you. Post your proposed constitutional amendment to Twitter using the hashtag Stack Overflow podcast. And if it is non-terrible, we may feature it in a future poll.
Yay, non-terrible.
We aim for it every day.
I think that's our opening soundbite right there. Yeah.
Mediocrity. Hooray, mediocrity.
Ship it.
And that's our show.
Thank you. So, having talked about constitutions, that brings us, I believe, to the most exciting portion, I think, of our podcast today. As Anil mentioned earlier, we have special guests in the podcast studio with us. Well, not with me, because I'm in Denver, but with most of us. We are super excited to welcome the co-founders of The Practical Dev, also known as dev.to, if you want to go check out the website right now. With us today are Jess Lee, co-founder, COO, developer, and marketing, logistics, and video production master. Welcome, Jess.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Mistress, is master gendered? I don't know. Welcome in any case. Ben Halpern, founder, CEO, developer, purveyor of general nonsense, and what I am comfortable saying might be the creator of the single best personal website, period, wow. On the planet, like ever. I insist, I command you, good listeners, like Cobra Commander or Hooded Cobra Commander, if you saved up the UPCs and sent them in for this special release. Go now, take a break. This podcast is not live when you're listening to it. So you may pause it and you won't miss one word of our confusing constitutional nonsense. Go to Ben Halpern, H-A-L-P-E-R-N, Ben spelled like you'd guess it is, .com. We'll wait. We don't have to wait. You have a pause button and then come back and hit play again. But welcome to the show, you guys.
And have your headphones in.
Yes, and volume turned all the way up.
Crank it up.
So one thing we always like to ask when we have developer guests on the show is, how did you get started? So maybe Jess, we'll start with you. Is tell us about when or how you first got interested in making machines do what you wanted them to.
Sure. I'd say it probably started in middle school. I grew up in like a very classic immigrant family, so my parents worked too hard and I was only a child, so I was home alone. And you know, you get lonely as a preteen. So I turned to the internet. I had a LiveJournal community that I loved. And of course, like wanting to change my background color, like how do I do that? So that's how that started. And then more recently, I found myself building Squarespace websites for people, just using their very basic Squarespace templates. I had a ball doing it. It was a lot of fun, very intuitive CMS they have there. But then I really felt the constraints of Squarespace. And then I was like, wait a second, like, how do you build a Squarespace? And like, that's the thought that I never had initially. And then once I had that thought, I realized that like, I wanted to start developing. But I was also working at a startup then, and I was a business analyst, and I saw that the developers were really the ones treated as first-class citizens, and I wanted to be part of that.
Exciting. Squarespace, if you're listening, this is what you get when you make us the only podcast on the entire planet you don't sponsor, is we bring people on to talk about your limitations and how to replace you.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that I started coding because of Casper mattresses.
How bumpy they are.
Yeah. Well, I didn't have one, so I couldn't sleep, so I was up coding all night. But if I had one and they sponsored the podcast.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I actually own a Casper mattress, and I won't tell you how I feel about it unless...
Sorry, digression.
So when you said you just started creating Squarespace websites for people, was that like as a threat who didn't ask you and it was like a really terrible, mean website? Like how did that... was these friends or like...
I actually had like a small business doing that.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I'm more interested in how LiveJournal opened your eyes. I used to work at LiveJournal, but like you were making templates and like styles for your site or like your journal.
I honestly can't even remember too much because I have, you know, I've deleted that since.
Yeah, okay. The content wise, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure the styles, the designs are beautiful, but you just,
yeah,
you know.
It was just like very simple tweaking. Mm-hmm. I feel like I remember Zynga a little bit more though, mm-hmm. if you remember that site too.
They were huge gateway drugs. I mean, the thing is, like, now we talk about them like, oh, these old tiny things that are lost in the past, but millions of people were there making blogs for themselves or whatever.
Yeah. They were like such early great community.
So Ben, tell us about your first forays or what brought you into programming.
Personality wise, it was kind of inevitable, I think.
I don't know what that means, but I like it.
Creative control of machines.
I don't know. Tinkering, a lot of tinkering, a lot of Lego, a lot of art, a lot of this and that and all sorts of stuff. My first computer hacking, my friend had a punk band and they wanted a website and I was like 12 or 13 or something. And they were making it themselves and I sort of got interested in that. I don't think we'd had the internet at the time in my house. We didn't get it until high school. Or besides, like, dial-up or something.
How did you build a website without the internet?
At my friend's house. Like, I went over there every day and started building websites.
Say, wow, those Squarespace folks are good. I wonder if we could retroactively invoice them for their sponsorship.
You know, we can build a website without the internet, though. You know, it's harder to deploy.
I think it's just a site then, really.
Right.
Yeah, so GeoCities was my life for several years. And then I sort of got in and out of that stuff. I got into sports. I played football through high school and college, and I did a bit of CS. I got a little bit back into CS in college. And then I dropped out. I was just 20-year-old, not knowing what I wanted to do with my life, and I thought my teacher was mean, so I dropped out of CS. And
is that the same teacher that follows us right now on Twitter?
Oh, I loved her.
Okay.
You were going to get some justice. You were like, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, like, yeah. My friends know who my mean CS teacher was.
Mm-hmm. Who's not applying themselves now, huh?
Yeah. It's really interesting because a couple of years ago I asked on Twitter, like, what made you stop learning how to code? And I got, like, hundreds of responses. It's just one of those things that I think kind of question people like to answer. And so many of them were basically, like, this person was a jerk to me. Like, it was a teacher. It was a classmate. It was certainly, like, for underrepresented folks, the people who were overrepresented being jerks. And it was really interesting that, like, it doesn't take much stop energy. And like there is, you know, confounding factors like, oh, this language is hard to learn or this framework was frustrating or whatever. But it's almost always these very social factors of like people were obnoxious or hostile or whatever.
Neil, if I recall from that poll, like kind of similar to Ben's story, like 65-70% of people quoted trying to make their own CMS as the reason they ultimately
quit. I mean, I had a job for many years making a CMS and kind of almost drove me away from anything having to do with electricity.
All right, so here's the thing. I've been remaking CMSs my whole life, it seems, at this point.
It just feels like that. Day one of the CMS feels like an entire lifetime.
Dev 2 is a CMS, and everyone asked me consistently when I was starting the project, why didn't you just use one of the off-the-shelf things? And I was like, well, I got my own like little things I want to do. I want to do it a little differently. I want less latency. I can't hack with this. I'll be better off building it myself. It was, you know, like 50th time is the charm. Right before I moved to New York, I had this little similar project, like technically similar to the idea of what I was building. And I had a phone call with a prospective investor who just sort of told me to quit the project, and I did. But he had like good advice. He was like, there's this website Medium coming out, and they're sort of doing the same thing, and they've got all these Twitter folks behind it or whatever. And it was enough to sort of like make me stop doing what I was doing. And it was maybe I don't know whether that was the right call or not, but I pretty much just started over with the same thing with Dev 2. And this time it's for good, I hope. Like nobody's going to convince me to stop doing this one.
That's good. It's the stick-to-itiveness. And I'm glad that somebody crushing your dreams in one area led to you pursuing your dreams in another, as opposed to giving up entirely.
So most of us in this room had been kind of vaguely familiar with some of your stuff from the Twitters. We all kind of are interested in developer-y topics, and we'd seen your wit and whimsy on Twitter. But I believe we first connected directly. I think Jess may have reached out, but it was one of these kind of charming modern-day internet kismet stories, right, where you guys actually put out this tweet and made a T-shirt for a fake book called Copying and Pasting from Stack Overflow, an obvious violation of our legally protected intellectual property. But somehow, despite that obvious conflict of interests and being so different, we all wound up the closest of friends, like Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan in every movie they're in. So for our listeners, that tuned in the hopes of hearing a wonderful romantic comedy and are not yet familiar with the Practical Dev, give us the summary of what is the Practical Dev?
Yeah, so the Practical Dev, twitter.com/thepracticaldev, started out as a Twitter account I started so I could get my feelings out there into the world.
Your feelings matter, Ben.
All of my feelings. And it just kept getting a little more popular and a little more fun here and there. And I really wanted to keep up with it. So I kept doing more and more. And I started this website, dev.to, to go along with it. And that is a place for programmers to also share their feelings, share what they're working on, let other people know what they're working on, and just kind of talk about what's up and let people know what they're doing so they have an idea what to do. Because programmers kind of are all in this together, and we're sort of holding hands and trying to figure it out together. So it's a big attempt to try to sort of figure it out together. And that's sort of an inflection point where it was growing bigger and I needed some help. So I reached out to my good friend Jess for some help, because she brought a lot of skills to the table that I don't have in terms of answering emails, organization, but she also
the
codes.
Mastery part.
Sounded like basic adult competence is what I heard there, but okay, that's great.
Yeah, yeah. So Jess is the adult in my life, and
it's good to have, one. It's always wise.
Yeah, so I had met Jess through a friend. Jess was getting into programming more professionally, and she wanted some mentoring, and she reached out through a friend of mine who I met when I was 11 at Buddhist summer camp in Nova Scotia. And
that's the most Canadian thing I've ever heard of.
And Jess knew Tara from college. No,
we were in the same music.
The same music program. So I'll let Jess talk about her whole perspective, because she's been a little quieter about this, all this.
Yeah. I think what's interesting about Dev 2 is that it caters to developers, both novices and experts. And I am much newer to development. And so I bring in the perspective of like, oh, like this is what sort of a newbie would want to see. And Ben has, you know, definitely a different perspective from me. And we're able to just like talk to the community. I feel like we're representative of the community in a lot of ways.
It's interesting how much of it is about sort of coding culture and the culture that developers have, as opposed to here's a new framework, here's a new toolkit. Was that an intentional choice? Have you ever been sort of tempted to go in different directions there?
Yeah, absolutely. That was fairly intentional, but we don't shy down from talking as much as possible about the technical details, but we try to still, even there, focus on the nuance.
Yeah, it's grounded in like human considerations.
Yeah, and we try to sort of touch on things that would get closed on Stack Overflow. Like, you know, and before even starting the website, I wanted to share more content on the Twitter, and I usually went to sort of the rest of the web for that, and questions that had been closed on Stack Overflow were exactly the kind of things I wanted to share, and that was a sort of a good guidepost.
So as we bring you on our podcast to promote your product, what you mostly want to highlight is that you set out to do the opposite of everything we did. Did I get that all right?
That's what I'm hearing, yeah.
Okay.
Using our trademark.
I was pretty nervous when I got that first email from you guys, when we made those shirts.
Has there ever been like a jokey takedown notice that goes out from Stack? It's like, we're going to crush you with our lawyers, and then like 2 minutes later a follow-up that's like, nah, just kidding.
No, we did hear from Tim O'Reilly in that vein, and I don't know, I still am not sure if he
did
was...
you steal one of their animals?
Isn't it an O'Reilly book or something?
Yeah,
like a pun, wasn't there?
The whole thing is in their wheelhouse. We endlessly parody and homage their book covers, and that is the joke, and it's absolutely a parody if Tim is listening.
Or the lawyers.
I can call Tim, we could just bring him in and just like, you know.
It sounded a little like you might have meant, if Tim's lawyers are listening, as a parody, protected under the exceptions to intellectual property law in cases where it would not be confused with having been published by the original intellectual property
owner. You're going to have to move back to Canada, aren't you?
I did see that on Twitter, though. I think he said something that was like, seemed a little more serious than I was expecting from him. Something like, they are using our trade dress after all, or something like that. Is that what you're referring to?
Kids love
the
trade dress.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, you know exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that was like a nervous day. I think, Jess, were you involved then?
Yes, I was very much so involved then.
Tim's not going to sue you. We'll.
But all it turned out was he just wanted some free t-shirts, right? That's how you resolved it. You just sent him a box of t-shirts and now everyone's friends.
We're friends. I mean, when he did that, I was already scheduled to give a talk at an O'Reilly conference. Like,
you sure that wasn't like a red wedding kind
of
thing?
Well, that's awkward.
That's rough.
Wow.
I like that because Tim's like this like affable old hippie, you know? Like, this idea of like cutthroat, you know, how dare you trample on our trade dress? You stepped on the train of my trade dress.
There's a super weird thing with all that IP stuff, which is like people will always come in and be like, oh, can I make this Stack Overflow shirt for myself? Is that okay? And if you go to a lawyer, they always say the same thing. You may never let people just use your trademark without challenging them. You will basically water it down until it is nothing. And you're like, I can't tell this kid he can't make himself a silkscreen Stack Overflow t-shirt because he's so excited. We need a better answer.
Yeah, the incentives are totally wrong.
So to be clear, if anybody's lawyers are listening, you are absolutely not allowed to use our trademark on any t-shirts.
Correct. But what I want everyone to know is we vigorously defend our intellectual property to protect the public from confusion about the publisher or purveyor of our goods and services. Side note, we've never sued any children or t-shirt makers. Unrelated
yes.
point.
Yes.
If you could see me right now, I'm actually wearing
a bootleg t-shirt. T-shirts.
Yeah, it's oh, possible, man. I might own a Stark Overflow t-shirt with like the wolf coming out of a little tray.
Oh.
Sometimes instead of suing them, we pay them money for things we own.
HBO is a much bigger company, so
right,
like it's good.
They have a lot of infinite lawyers.
Yeah.
It's dozens. Like a Kleenex box. Like you just pull one out and the next one pops up.
They're a law firm that makes movies.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they're a bunch of lawyers who happen to have some TV shows. Anyway, so it's been nice working with you, I think. Shame we have to cut you loose.
Enjoy those lawsuits.
You died on the hill of a t-shirt.
So I encourage everyone to check out the site. It is super developer targeted. One thing I like about it is people talk about it, it feels like there's a better breadth of experiences. It's not like these things. Like Hacker News has people often sharing their stories here and there and forget what is sometimes the cesspool of comments. But even the post selection has a lot of like, something's got to be resonant to like tons of people where everyone has shared this experience. What I liked on Practical Dev was it feels like you see these things that are not universal, but are shared by a bunch of people. So you get into this like, oh, 10% of us have totally had that. And someone's talking about it. It's kind of cool. One thing that struck me in reading like all your like your about page, you guys have a really robust like community guidelines, right? For a kind of otherwise minimalist site. Like it feels like you've thought a lot about trying to really be, I don't know, having more breadth of opinion and being a more welcoming community. How does that go into sort of, it's not just Medium for developers, right? There's more of a community element to it, it feels like. Is that how much of that was kind of what you were working on coming in?
You describe that way better than we ever have.
I'm looking for a job in marketing, even though I don't do that. So
all you have to do is wear one of these bootleg t-shirts and right. that you can go pursue that job.
Problem takes care of itself.
What you just said is exactly what we love hearing from people, but it's also stuff that we don't like to just like deliberately say. Like we ground ourselves in trying to be super inclusive. Part of that just from my own experience on like Hacker News, like really difficult, aggressive site to navigate, like especially as a newbie, you know, kind of also as a woman. But
you know, you could learn to do that in a weekend if you tried.
But yes, you know, we don't go around being like, we're the diverse community or whatnot. But so it's really exciting when people just pick up on that. And that is something we really try and represent.
What are things that have taken off on the site that you were sort of surprised by, that they resonated, that people really responded to it?
I'm always really happy and surprised when a newer programmer's take on something really resonates with everyone.
Yeah, so the experienced coders are like, you nailed articulating this way.
Yeah, so like one programmer, Vidi, every week she writes an article about a computer science topic, and they do awesomely with our community, and they're really grounded in the CS. And she's sort of self-teaching herself as she writes this stuff. And every week, everyone sort of that's into it reads it as like a part of the thing they do that week. And I've seen some of the comments from some of the more experienced, like 25 years in Clojure developers on our site, like genuinely just offering nothing but praise. And that is just awesome because it really touches on everything everyone is about. It really is about sort of her writing this stuff. It's not just a Wikipedia article on this kind of stuff. And it's really about herself and her identity and her journey and her background. I think she came to software from just teaching, like in school, which shows in her writing and with lots of stuff like that. Every time there's someone sort of who finds their voice on our platform, and she actually started writing on Medium, and I told her she should write on our site too, because she was only getting one or two hearts for every post, and I discovered it, and I was like, we'll tweet this to 115,000 people every time you write it, so share your stuff with us in our community. And that one really sticks out because she's just been such a consistent presence with us. But other than that, yeah, it's just like anytime people sort of cross boundaries or sort of really level up or just tell us something that they love about the site that we weren't even trying to do, or the community or anything, or anytime we meet people in real life, and they want to take pictures with us. It's all pretty surreal, you know, like, because it's not like it's the biggest thing in the world, but it's bigger than any of my other crappy side projects.
We were commenting before you got here about that obvious difference and really just how crappy your other projects had been. It was all very surprising. So is there anything else in addition to dev.to, the practical dev on Twitter? I encourage you to check out both. Anything else you guys want to highlight, promote, share with our listeners, whether it's side projects, charities or causes you're involved with? What can folks that enjoy the work they know about go read or get involved with that you like or believe in?
So we run this nonprofit called Make a Diff, where we encourage programmers to get together and work on civic-oriented actions. Make a diff, it's kind of a play on word. It's a pun.
Diff can mean two different. I love it.
That's wonderful and despicable.
You can thank me for the puns. We had taken action by sort of just getting together and having meetups, and where people got together and hacked on each other's resistance-oriented projects. And it's actually been too long since we've had our last meetup, because our other co-founder in this venture, Saran, who runs Code Newbie, she's been so busy with Codeland, which she just put on.
Yeah.
And that was amazing. It was like the best conference either of us have ever been to.
She's incredible.
She's been so busy that like we can't do anything without her, it seems.
I think the whole industry feels that way.
Yeah, nothing gets done without Saran. So if you're part of Make a Diff and you're sort of annoyed that we haven't done as much lately, blame our incompetence for not being able to do anything without Saran. But now that Codeland's over, we're going to figure it out and we're going to have more of these.
I have another. So Ben, I'm surprised you didn't mention this actually, but several weekends ago, I got messages from Ben on like a Saturday night at 4 a.m. really excited about another side project.
Sounds like a great partner, by the way. Just fantastic.
And it's called 1PR. And basically, it's just an open repo. You can submit pull requests and just turn. We're just like all building a site together, but it's 1PR a day. So if you want to contribute to that, the repo is...
Cool. Yeah, github.com/thepracticaldev/1PR. And it's up to one. Basically, if there's an open PR and it merges, I accept it. Like, I glance at it, and if it works, I accept it. And it's interesting because I started it with the intention of having no thoughts for this project, and it's kind of taken this very meta direction. And it will hopefully live on forever, even though sometimes I forget to make a PR. And that's why I made the language up to one PR, so often I'll forget. And if anybody's holding the project back, it's me sometimes. But that's been fun. And if nothing else, it constantly gives me ideas about how open source works. And I've never been the maintainer of any serious open source project, but we plan to open source the whole dev.to code base. And I've got a lot of learning to do. And this has been a bit of a crash course, and it's been a lot of fun.
That idea for 1PR is really fascinating. I want to make sure we drag you onto Glitch at some point where we can just have people sort of contributing real time. Because I love that idea of the like a constrained way to contribute, where you're not like it's open-ended and I have to know everything in the world. I just did one thing.
Yeah, speaking of which, I love Glitch. I love the concept. I go to Glitch a lot and I poke around and I haven't like done anything yet. I think that's kind of the way a lot of these things work. And you got to kind of like get into it.
For a while before they click.
But all the concepts and all the images and all the design and the branding, I get like the whole thing.
Are you listening, Squarespace? That's how it can go. Boom. When you pay out the money.
Yeah, that's what a real sponsor likes to hear. No, in all seriousness, I mean, that's wonderful to hear. But I also think of like so much of the ethos of what you do is this very approachable, very tractable. Like this is, you can do this. It's not the Herculean amount of work. And that's a lot. I think that informs a lot of how we think about Glitch too, is this like, there's just a place you can start and you're not going to be overwhelmed.
Yeah, that's what I would have used instead of GeoCities when I was younger, and it's sort of got the same
feeling.
We
copied it. I made a GeoCities template. You can actually do a GeoCities site, and for Jess, there's a LiveJournal site.
Amazing. Can't wait.
It's funny. I'm surprised your personal homepage isn't the one that took off. Yeah, I'm surprised that wasn't the one that took off.
You got to go see the homepage, people, if you haven't yet. Stop the podcast.
What's the address for that?
You will not be disappointed. It is benhalpern.com.
Checking it out right now.
Turn your sound up.
Turn it off. Don't turn the sound up. This is professional radio, people.
Oh, this is really something. This is better than poop.bike, if you've ever seen that.
my homepage. That's what, when I open a new tab, that's where it goes.
Oh, this is fantastic. Why it didn't take off, I can't imagine.
Oh, good. We got to hear the sound.
Yeah.
Didn't
there
do
we go.
The only thing we asked you to do.
Yeah. Hey, that's a great segue into a segment that we were going to talk about, which is that we all face challenges sometimes. We all have our little failures. Maybe I will actually lean upon you, Jay, to articulate what's possible when we confront our failures.
I mean, I found if you have enough failures and, you know, it's easy to fight them and kind of try to not recognize them. But ultimately, if you accept the failures and just how many there have been and how big of a failure they were, my understanding is at some point you can become the CEO of a wonderful software company like Fog Creek or places like that. That's my...
I failed my way up. Is that what you're saying? That was like, I'm sitting right here and you just said that.
Is that not what you're saying, Anil? I thought that...
We all have our challenges.
Seemed obvious to me.
Maybe we can find a more forgiving framing of that.
So our new segment we're trying out called Failure is Always an Option. That's something our own dev Kevin Montrose always says about any project, which is always inspires confidence in everyone working on that project. Kevin is actually chiming in right now on chat. He says, no matter what happens, we'll always have our collective failure to unite us. I think that's really, really captures the message right there. The idea of failure is always an option is to share some of our own spectacular failures, sometimes amusing, sometimes less amusing. So I'll start by sharing one of mine. So I was racking my brain for the best of my failure stories, and I'm sure there's a better one, but I had just joined Stack Overflow, and we were working on Area 51, which was this brand new thing at that time for letting users propose new Stack Exchange sites, and it seemed like it was like one of the most exciting projects I'd ever worked on, but we needed to make a change, and as part of that change, we decided we needed to communicate with the top users to let them know that we were making a change. I think it was when we decided to throw away all the reputation that they had earned agonizingly and start over. So I was going to send out a very nice email that I spent a lot of time crafting, you know, really nicely worded. But, you know, we didn't have code at that time. So I was just going to send it through Gmail. I found out, okay, you can send 200 emails at a time through Gmail. So I batched them all up and I very carefully pasted their email addresses in, but unfortunately pasted them in the to field instead of the BCC field and exposed everybody's email addresses to everybody else, which many of them helpfully pointed out to me after I sent
those emails.
It
wasn't a silent failure, in other words. It wasn't a silent bug. Yeah.
No.
I hope they pointed it out by replying to all. Is that how they did it? Because...
I think more than one.
That would be a thread that never ends.
Reply all. Just
side note. Really, if you reply to all after receiving a reply to all on an inappropriately long list asking to be removed from the list, you should be legally prohibited from owning a computer.
This is not a constitution question.
I'm just saying.
So that's at least one of my failures. We also invited special guest Matt Sherman.
Hello.
Who's now one of our engineering managers, but was a developer who wrote code before that, to share one of his more amusing stories.
Yeah, well, talk about failing up. They got me away from the code, and now it's all Google Docs and spreadsheets. Yeah.
He was failing so much, we had to make him a manager.
That's right. So I was about 6 months into my tenure here at Stack Overflow. This was 2010, and I'd been here for about 6 months. As a developer, I came in already as an admirer and a user of Stack Overflow, and couldn't believe that I was, you know, actually coding on the site. And at that time, one of the things I was working on was the ad server code. And we have a little, if you look at stackoverflow.com, you'll see a job ad in the on the right-hand side. So I was one of the people that wrote the first version of that. And I was debugging some JavaScript. And the easiest way to debug JavaScript, at least in my mind at that time, was to pop up a little alert with the little value that I wanted at the time. It's possible that console.log didn't exist at that time, or I was merely ignorant, so I was popping up dialogues.
I think those are still the Firebug days. It certainly wasn't built into the browser.
We call this foreshadowing.
Yes. So I was popping up. It's a modal dialogue, which means it blocks everything. And ads appear on every page on Stack Overflow. So I committed the code, which was in a different code base. It wasn't even on Stack Overflow, but the ad gets served on Stack Overflow. And it had this debugging line in it. And 100% of people that showed up to Stack Overflow got a nice window that said alert false. For about 15 minutes. 100% of users, wow. All your page hits popped up to tell you that it was false. So that got caught pretty quick and we fixed it pretty quick. But that led to sort of a funny thread on Meta, our site where we talk about Stack Overflow. We did a 5 whys on it that turned out pretty funny as well. So if you go to Meta, we'll link in the show notes here how that turned out. But it was very embarrassing, especially since I was new.
So you referenced 5 whys, which some of our listeners may be familiar with, but give a quick overview of what the 5 whys approach to postmortems is.
Sure. 5 whys is the idea is you should ask why 5 times as to why something happened. Because there's always the immediate cause, but that cause usually has a basis in something else, something more systemic. So you ask, well, why did this bug happen? It's like, well, I committed debugging code. Why did you commit debugging code? Well, we don't have good standards. Why don't we have good standards? Well, you know, something, something. So that's like a 5 whys. You try to get to a root cause.
That was a Toyota thing, wasn't it? It was like a Japanese, I think it was Toyota.
That rings a bell, yeah.
Yeah, the 5 whys on the Meta post, which I'm pretty sure I wrote at the time. This was my analysis of the situation as Matt's manager. Why, number one? Why? Because Matt deployed a version of the careers ad code with a debugging line in it. Why? Because he forgot to remove it before pushing his change. Why? Because he did not eat a nutritious breakfast, which studies have proven improves school performance. And I cited the study. It's important to note. Why? Because he moved recently and was preoccupied worrying about his upcoming commute, which I linked to. Why? Because he got a great deal on an apartment. So there you go. Five whys.
Also, if you're trying this yourself, they don't explain it all that clearly. But if you just go up to someone and you're like, why? It doesn't work. You have to pause after each one.
When my son was three, he used to do that. I didn't know that he was so good at management.
Yeah, it sounds very precocious. Yeah.
It takes about three whys from a kid in my experience. And you're like, you don't need to get to five before you realize you are explaining nonsense you've never understood. It's like, but why do you have to wear a tie to work every day? And you're like, because... we're crazy. I have nothing.
The questions are too profound.
It only takes you three whys to get to God, usually.
That's a Louis C.K. thing, too. Eventually, you get to metaphysical questions, and the kid asks, like, the 30th why, and it's like, well, because that which is, and that which is not cannot be.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, too. There's this sort of common refrain in all of our failures, which is the, like, in retrospect, this was totally foreseeable.
Right.
It's very obvious.
Foreseeable, but unforeseen.
Yes.
All right, other mistakes. I think Ben said he had one to share.
I have plenty of mistakes to share. If people want to listen, it might be easier to list the non-failures. But recently on Dev2, we had a free sticker promotion where we just gave away free stickers to members, anybody, and we still are running it. You know, if you go to dev.to/free stickers, you can have free stickers. And we
including
also,
the copying and pasting from Stack Overflow sticker.
Yeah. That Matt has on his laptop that no one can see. So I'm just...
I can see it. I'm not imagining it.
I might not be wearing my glasses.
We'll put a picture in the blog post.
Picture in your mind. It looks like you think it does.
So we also give away t-shirts randomly to some of the people who submit that form. So we ask for your t-shirt size. And I had like a typo in that form. And closer to the database, it knew not to accept the wrong values. But on the form itself, accepted anything, and for a while we didn't notice that nobody who t-shirt size was medium got any.
Yeah, no unisex mediums came through at all.
Yeah, no mediums got their t-shirts.
Kind of at the middle of the curve.
That's okay.
There.
That's not a popular size.
It's sort of an edge case medium t-shirt. I don't know who wears that. That's weird. So we sent an email to everyone. We sort of had the logs of like who it was and stuff that did that, but it was really complicated. It was easier just to send an email out telling everyone who may have submitted the form or not in that time span just to try doing it again. And then we fixed the problem by just kind of fixing the typo, but also making it sort of explode on the user if anything really went wrong like that. The real problem was that it failed reasonably quietly and we didn't really notice what was going on and we were hurried and it was complicated, and that's one of many mistakes I make every day.
But we have a very forgiving community, because when we sent that apology email, I got a bunch back saying, don't be mad at Ben, like it happens. And I was like, okay. I'm a little mad, but you know, I appreciate it.
Jess did say in the email, this was Ben's fault.
Ooh,
we know. I told her to do that. We were
blame first culture is always really good.
We have a lot of ironic blaming in our culture, and as long as people are on the same page about that, we have fun with it.
Irony and sarcasm, the two things that the internet communicates perfectly well. Extremely high fidelity.
Plain text formats are great.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They're like, yes, I understood what you meant. The opposite of what you wrote.
Anybody else have a mistake to share?
Yeah, I actually have a very classic mistake, which is pushing all of my secret keys to production and then having to delete my entire repo. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah. We've all been there.
Oh, no. Who among us has not pushed secrets to production?
It could be worse. You could be the United States press secretary and tweet out your password roughly twice a day.
That's a very rough estimate. I appreciate it.
So we joke about the five whys, but postmortems are something we think a lot about here and how we kind of handle outages. Matt, I know this is something you've talked a lot about and written about.
Yeah, it's a very important thing on teams to have the sort of trust where you can make mistakes, where people can raise their hand. If you screw something up, you raise your hand, say, oh, that was me. I'm fixing it now. And then everybody can learn from it. And everybody knows in the future, they won't be afraid to take chances there. And they won't be afraid to sort of volunteer when they have made a mistake so that other people can learn. There's a term for that. I think it was coined by a guy named John Alspaugh, who is over at Etsy, last I heard, called the blameless postmortem. And the idea is to, yes, of course, there's a person that made the mistake. But to, as you go over the history of the thing, talk about it in terms of facts. Don't have a blame tone to it. Just talk about facts and have it be sort of a blameless idea where we're optimizing for learning from this thing, building trust and learning and getting away from the notion of blame, you know, on a personal level.
Yeah, a big part of it is sort of seeing human error as inevitable.
Yeah.
It's like an operational concept, which is like, instead of saying, oh, this person made a mistake, what's the problem? Well, they're a dummy. It's saying, well, this person made a mistake, and the problem is that our system, you know, allowed that to get to production, and nobody reviewed it, and no test caught it, and, you know, and things like that. You know, that's, so instead of seeing it as, oh, let's blame the person who made the mistake, it's, let's figure out how to make the system more resilient to human error, which is inevitable.
Yeah, I don't know a whole lot about this field. I've read a little bit, but there's a whole field about human error, and I believe they call it systems thinking. And that's the basic idea, is that human error doesn't actually explain anything. You know, we talk about human error, we think we've solved whatever the problem is because a human made an error. But the idea of this field is that has no explanatory power. So you have to go further and talk about the systems.
There was a similar thing, I think it was at NASA, I read, I think it was in the book, The Power of Habit, which talks about how they're trying to institute a sort of cultural embrace of almost exactly that, more risk-taking with a comfort than when you fail regularly, breaking down why you fail, but not being at all sad that you did fail. And one of the first things they did, like they wanted to attack the cultural problem of sort of fear of failure. This was the unmanned rocket era. Everyone cheered when rockets exploded, like unintentionally. And the idea was, we once again have gone through a full cycle and did the thing we set out to try to do. And now that it's failed, we can learn something. And then they would go back through what went wrong. But they wanted to train people to say a launch is a success because it's a cycle of learning. And if that launch ends in an explosion, that is still a success. That would have been less appropriate, obviously, in the manned rocket program. But they would all in the control room literally cheer, apparently, when these things blew up. I thought it was a very interesting way of like reframing almost the emotional reaction to a failure.
I cheer when I see fireworks. Does that count? Does that mean I'm a rocket scientist?
Yes, yep. It's basically exactly what it means.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Mm-hmm.
When I used to work at dosomething.org, we used to have this thing called Failure Fest, which is really just to learn from your failures, but just to be celebratory and excited about what you learned from those failures.
Right.
And at Practical Dev, we like the idea of just encouraging people to take risks and just say that, you know, maybe if you need to later on, just ask for forgiveness.
Yeah. And using the word we instead of I and you as much as possible. Yeah. And like even about the good things say we, the bad things say we. Why did we write this code? Why did we decide this? Why did we do any of this? Even when it clearly you're talking to one person who did the thing, why did we do this? We think it encourages people to, and we don't do this well all the time, but we're trying hard to get better at all the little things we need to get better at together.
Making software is really hard. I think we're actually going to talk about one of the specific ways in which it's hard in news today. And for news, we are going to go to Ilana.
Face App, a photo editing app for selfies, has apologized for building an allegedly racist algorithm into its, quote, hotness filter. Users quickly pointed out that the hotness filter simply used lightening effects on skin tones to achieve its mooted, beautifying effect.
I thought, actually, the fact that the creator apologized was surprising and interesting. I think that's like a big change. Yeah. I think, you know, you go back, whatever, 3, 4, or 5 years ago, and, you know, Instagram sort of did the same thing where they're like, this is the filter that makes you look attractive. And it's like, it just makes you lighter. And they were much more defensive about it. And I thought, you know, yeah, obviously, like, software is hard. AI is really hard. Doing visual effects on people's faces in real time is extremely hard. And to be like, yeah, I screwed up and I'm going to try and do better. But I'm like, well, you know, I mean, the ideal, obviously, is you never have bugs, but real world.
I think what's interesting is, like, the idea that an algorithm can be racist is something that breaks a lot of people's brains, because there's like, it's almost two definitions of racism. And the sort of simple, facile definition of racism is like a person who dislikes people of another race. And it's like, well, by definition, a computer is indifferent. It has no opinions. How can it be racist? But I feel like it's becoming more and more understood. I hope it's becoming more and more understood, acknowledged that, like, if the assumptions and the data that went into the, especially like a machine learning algorithm, are biased racially, then what comes out is going to be biased racially. That... Bias is inevitable.
Human, though, so it...
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It reflects all built by humans.
How could an algorithm possibly not be racist? It's sufficiently complicated and enough people are working on it. It's going to have problems.
Yeah.
You have a very dystopian view of our robot future, I think.
Well, no, I mean, I think it's like the more sophisticated view is like racism is a system. And then you're like, oh, yeah, systems have bugs. And, you know, software reflects the systems that create it. And like, we're like, yeah, the sort of classic thing of the, you know, whether your website looks like your org chart because you're just trying to mimic the way your organization works. And we think of software the same way. And there's even things that aren't like deliberately hurtful. Like I used FaceApp and it has like, it can make you look like a man or a woman or young or old. And I did young and it very clearly sort of mapped my face to the face of a young African-American boy, young black boy. And I'm not black. And so it was just very like, it was jarring. I was like, a kid's cute. Like that, you know, I would be nice if I looked like that as a kid, but like there was no way that was going to happen. And I sort of like tweeted this like, well, that's interesting. And somebody came back and they're like, you know, they probably have a really naive classifier that does a first pass on like guessing it race. And that's how it sort of, you know, they train the AI and it just mischaracterized on the first pass and everything after that is this like happenstance. So like as a coder, you can totally imagine how it happens. But the fact that the bugs there are not like, well, we got a typo in this message, but instead is this like, I don't see myself as being that person or somebody else might be hurt by being seen that way. It's a jarring example of what like a slight bug in software can do.
I think that's right. And I think it's interesting because the interesting story, the thing we want to latch onto is like, look how outright crazy racist this is. Like, what does the hotness thing do? It makes, like, if you're a black person, it makes you look whiter. And that's obviously not what happened, right? I don't think. And if we ever at all generous of spirit in making assumptions, there's a different problem, which is what they did presumably is they tried this on lots and lots of white people. And it worked over and over again. And it's like, it's not that I think making people of color look lighter is a good thing. It's actually like not this overt sort of attractiveness assumptions that don't cross racial barriers. It's more of like a lack of inclusiveness. Like we're always a little nervous saying like diverse teams build better products. Like that shouldn't be the only reason you want a diverse team or you want to be inclusive. But this is this great example of like, if you're hearing back and testing from users that aren't too homogeneous and you have employees that aren't too, someone's going to be like, dude, every time I use this, I get a little whiter. That doesn't seem so good.
Yeah.
And it feels like that problem of like, you need to figure out if you're getting feedback from different types of people of all types, even beyond gender and race, I think, to see this kind of stuff ahead of time.
Even beyond team composition, I think there's just literacy in the issues that come up. So there's the,
yeah.
You know, almost any large scale AI is trained on data that are from the internet. And, you know, like even within, you know, communities of color, like the one I'm, you know, part of being South Asian, there's like colorism and the sort of like in India, like skin lightening products are a huge market. And so there, even if you just did it entirely in one community like that, and you're like, we trained on the photos people rated as hottest, right? And they're like, oh, well, they all said they wanted the one that you were lighter in. You could actually get the same results, right? So there's these like really, really well-established and difficult social challenges that are just captured by the software. So it's accurately reflecting the world. And the idea is like, well, it's supposed to do better than that, right? There's lots of examples. If you look at like a subway map app here in New York, like there are stations that are closed for repairs or whatever, but you don't omit them from the map, right? You're like, it's there and hopefully it'll be reopened in a month and they're just doing this repair. And that idea of like, you don't want to reflect a brokenness, you want to reflect the way that things should work is a hard thing to capture in software, especially when you're using, as is the case with like FaceApp, technologies that are new. There wasn't an off-the-shelf way to do this kind of thing on a mobile device even 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And from a business perspective, they're not going to make more money by getting this right from a racial perspective. Like, they get it right if everything works and people have fun, but nobody's going to notice if it just works.
Yeah, only the failure state is visible.
Yeah. So so there's less incentive for a company that's moving fast and breaking things to pay attention to some of these smaller details. There's plenty of ways to catch that despite that incentive, but it is a bit of a perverse incentive because the failure state is the only visible one in this case.
But this developer didn't do what I would have expected even, you know, a year or two ago as the default, which is the defensive, I didn't mean to do anything wrong. You're the ones accusing me of this thing. Software is neutral. How dare you say that? You're the real racist.
You're the ones who are racist.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Like, you're the real racist. And that's like typically that 4-point plan. And I'm sure somebody, you know, in the Hacker News comments said that, but like the developer themselves didn't say that. I think it's like this big leap forward to where they're like, yeah, you know what? The bug and I'm going to try and fix it. Like, I don't expect people to get it right the first time, every time. Like, software is really hard, but I think the fact that they're recognizing this is a category of bug. You know, if we said, oh, you have a bad, you know, password hashing algorithm, they wouldn't be like, how dare you? My passwords are great. You know, they'd be like, all right, I'll fix the bug.
You just typed
right,
a bad
right,
password.
Exactly. You're the real insecure password. You know, they said, they're like, no, I got to fix the bug. And I think that we've gotten social failures into that category broadly is something to celebrate.
And I think to your point, there's an even softer version of that that comes up a lot that just it's easy to learn how to avoid, which is when you step into an area where you say or do something that causes some harm that you didn't mean, especially when you sit, like I'm in basically all of the privileged groups, like I don't have any of those challenges, and you get into this and someone's like, oh my God, what you did is sort of, you know, racist or whatever in some way, your immediate instinct is that's not who I am. That challenges my identity and everything I know. And so what you say is like, all that matters is I didn't mean that. Like, I didn't mean that. I'm not mm-hmm. that person. And that's what you need to understand that makes your argument not right. And what you've just skipped over is harm was caused. And you mm-hmm. really didn't mean the harm. And the first thing to do is confront, like, sometimes behaviors cause harm. And when that happens, you should be sorry, even if you didn't mean it. You should want to do better next time. And it's okay to add on to, once you acknowledge that, I think, how much you really didn't intend that, kind of walk through where you were mm-hmm. to, you know, flesh yourself out. But our instinct is, don't say it was racist, because that's not what I meant. And it's like the wrong discussion. Right.
The way you show you had good intent is by responding in a way that shows you want to fix it.
Right, right. But you focus on how much it challenges your own sense of self, which feels so important at the time, and it's so unhelpful.
Well, it's like people will already know that about you if you do the rest of the work to fix the bug.
Right. That's a great way to put it.
This stuff keeps me up at night, sort of trying to ensure the inclusiveness of our little community and platform. It's easier said than done to try to hope everyone feels included and involved, and bad incidents are going to happen. And sometimes I sort of go to bed thinking about our response strategy when we don't catch something, when something goes wrong, when we blatantly mess up, or when we didn't account for something we should have. And I hope sort of we can be that mature.
I'm trying to think of that. Like, there was that incident where I think you had just made a joke, but you had like a woman CEO on Twitter, but like, that CEO had made a mistake, and then one of our followers were upset that like the person who made a mistake was a woman. But when we had thought about it, it was mostly, oh, like, we want to normalize the idea of like women CEOs. Yeah. But like, to her, like that was a negative. And it was really interesting seeing her perspective. And like someone said just now, I think apologizing like first because harm was done is the most important, and then sort of backtracking, explaining your intentions, but like defending yourself is not the first step.
Yeah, I talked to her for like an hour about sort of what her thoughts on the whole situation was and how she thought we might have handled things differently. And sort of we learned a lot, but, you know, I still think we made the right choice. And actually that particular tweet was overwhelmingly shared by women because most people got it. And a few people were particularly offended. And on average, it was exceptionally well taken. But it was interesting, like anyone who took it the wrong way, because they have lower expectations about what people like us on Twitter might be making jokes about. It was an interesting sort of learning experience, another data point for future efforts.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know, I think the cool thing there is the dialogue, right? Like that you went back, you guys talked together, tried to work through like how you took it differently and what the perspectives were. I also think one of the challenges, it's easy, especially when you, again, when you sit on the privileged side of things, to sort of be like, I don't want to wander into that zone because like I'm going to say something totally well-intentioned and even most people may think it's helpful and I'm going to get attacked. And I think that's what gets super dangerous is when we're not willing to say like, let's have good conversations and learn and accept we're going to do some stuff wrong. And as long as we keep working to do a lot better, that's better than trying to avoid, I think, that tough stuff.
Yeah. And it's fun. The people stuff is tricky, but I think it is similar to software, is the sort of you inherit all the bugs of your environment, right? And when the abstraction gets leaky and people bring with them their preconceptions and what's outside, you know, you can say, well, that happened because of the platform I was using. It's not my bug. But ultimately, you know, if they see it from you, it is your bug. And so you sort of have to fix it.
And to be crystal clear, my last point was not, look how hard it is for those of us with privilege to have to deal with these issues of bias in society. We have the unbelievable privilege of being able to avoid it much of the time, which is quite unfair. So didn't want that to come off that way.
I think that's actually a really good note to wrap things up on, that idea that we have a responsibility to each other. And also that there is a lot of fun in tracking down these bugs. I mean, I think that idea that we can troubleshoot these things together is really powerful. You have been listening to the Stack Overflow podcast, recorded Thursday, April 27th, 2017. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend, spread the word, subscribe on iTunes, force others to subscribe on iTunes. Most important thing you can do, iTunes, subscribe. That's the goal. The podcast has been brought to you by the CSV file format as well as glitch.com. Our audio engineer is Carlos Hernandez. Audio editor is David Greenlee. Our technology concierge is Michael Rosa. News editor is Ilana Itzaki. Producer is Jess Pardue. Executive producer is Caitlin Pike. On behalf of our guests, Ben and Jess from Practical Dev, and as always, Jay Hanlon, David Fullerton, and your guest host, Danielle Dash, thank you for joining us. We will see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Failure is always the best way to learn. Retracing your steps till you know. Have no fear, your wounds will heal.
I should mention I come from a loving family. My dad is wonderful and actually listens to this sometimes.
Wow.
Wow,
that's...
I saw a picture of the two of you close together recently.
Close together.
It was on Twitter. We built a cage to keep squirrels. Yeah.
Wow. So
we
built cage to keep squirrels.
Barricade.
A squirrel cage.
Sorry, that came out a little like young serial killer.
Yeah,
to be clear,
you're not young.
To keep the squirrels out. The tomatoes.
Well, why
don't
you
don't
let the squirrels into the cage?
I don't know if more talking will help this.
No.
I'm confused by this. So you're keeping them out or keeping them in? Give us an answer.
Definitely.
So the squirrels are the enemy. The tomatoes are the friend.
Okay.
Tweet at us with pro if you want him to keep the squirrels out and con if you want him to keep the squirrels in.
Team squirrel.
Okay,
team
now
tomato.
This squirrel is the one in front of me, but next squirrel. If it's Tuesday,
right?
That's tough.
I don't think squirrels are allowed to open gates on Tuesdays. They have to bring a goy squirrel with them to open the gate.
Wow.
Please send your letters to Anil Dash, care of Fog Creek Software.
I'll fight the entire internet. I don't give a damn.
Hooray, mediocrity.